Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Con artists. We hate them, but we're fascinated by them. To it, the popular movie and play Catch Me If You Can, about a guy, Frank Abagnale, who successfully pretended to be a doctor, lawyer, airline pilot, all before he was 18. But how do we get conned? After all, most of us think we're too smart to be conned. We know if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. And we wouldn't fall for an email from a Nigerian prince saying there's $10 million just waiting for us if only we'd send in a $200 license fee, or even fall for one of those more recent scams in the emails that that appears to come from somebody we know, saying that they're stranded in Europe and they need $500 to get out. And yet we do fall for cons. I myself, as a 20-year-old traveling in Europe, got taken in by the three-card Monte scam twice. The hand indeed is quicker than the eye. As taxpayers, we've all been scammed by so-called, quote, welfare queens. I recall the famous Linda Taylor, who used 30 names, 80 addresses, 15 phone numbers to collect food stamps, Social Security, veterans benefits for four non-existent deceased veteran husbands, as well as welfare. Her tax-free cash income alone was, in today's dollars, $250,000 a year. How do we protect ourselves from getting conned, especially in the workplace, which is the focus of Work with Marty Nemko? Are there ways we can ethically use techniques used by con artists, ethically underlined? With me to answer such questions is Marina Konnikova. She graduated magna cum laude from Harvard, got a PhD in psychology from Columbia. She now blogs for The New Yorker and is author of a new book, amazingly well-sourced, truly, and just filled with meat. It's called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Maria Konnikova, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty.
My pleasure. Well, few of us would call for cons like the email from the Nigerian prince, but what sorts of cons do even many smart people fall for?
You know, you would be surprised at just how many people fall for even the Nigerian prince, because he's not always the Nigerian prince. I mean, all that is the Spanish prisoner, which is an age-old con. We have historical evidence of it dating back to at least the 1500s. And the original story, of course, goes that there's a Spanish prisoner. He's incredibly wealthy. He's in prison. And if you just give him a little bit of money, you will get a huge return because he's very, very generous with his cash, and he would be incredibly grateful. And so all that setup really does is you give me a little and you'll get a lot. Mm. And it's, you can phrase it in so many different ways, and it becomes a really alluring proposition. But there are so many scams out there today that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people fall for every single year. So we have sweetheart scams and catfishing scams online where you have people posing as someone else and you get people romantically involved with individuals who don't even exist, and mm-hmm. they find themselves completely just devastated emotionally usually at the end of these and financially. You have the IRS scam that's rampant around this time, also in April, where you'll get a big call from the mean IRS that says, you owe us money. You will be arrested. And people get really, really scared mm-hmm. and start handing over money. Of course, mm-hmm. this is a scam. This doesn't actually happen. You have phone calls that happen all the time. The grandparent scam, incredibly common. This is a variation on the, your granddaughter has been in a car crash. We need to airlift her out. We need money immediately. People get really worried. They send money, and this happens in reverse, too. Your grandmother has suffered a terrible accident. We need cash right now to take care of her. The grandkid gives money. So all of these things have kind of this emotional component in common. They're really trying to hook us. They're really trying to get us so involved that we stop thinking rationally.
Yeah. Of course, this show focuses on work, and so kind of focus in that area. We normally think of cons as associated with business, mm-hmm. but even in careers or fields we tend to respect, we're not immune. For example, there's a musician you wrote about in your book, Mamoru Samaguchi, who tried to enhance his reputation about it as a musician by capitalizing on our current fascination with disabled people who overcame their disability. Mm-hmm. Tell us about him.
So he did something that just in retrospect seems not just unbelievable, but also really exploitative. He was a musician, a composer, and his music was never really that popular. I mean, he was able to be a musician, but that's about it. And then he lost his hearing. He became deaf. And all of a sudden, people really wanted to hear what it was that he had to write. I mean, he was a modern-day Beethoven. Mm-hmm. And people just really bought this story. He wrote this beautiful piece, Hiroshima, which was then played at the anniversary of the Hiroshima mm-hmm. bombing. A Japanese skater was going to skate to it in the Olympics. And that's when someone came forward and said, hey, I am the ghostwriter. I've been writing all of this music. And that's not all. So it's not just that this guy didn't write any of his own music. It was that he wasn't even deaf. He had faked this whole Beethoven thing so that people would pay attention, because the music in and of itself wasn't that remarkable, but the story made it absolutely irresistible.
Yeah, we hear that all the time. It makes me, just listening to you makes me wonder, you know, it seems like every Hollywood actor gets brownie points for saying, I was a heroin addict, I got abused, I got raped, I got this, I got that, and I overcame it. One wonders, you know, how many of those, you know, nobody goes and checks to see if the kid was abused by her uncle. As a child, you wonder how many of those are publicity stunts and cons.
Yeah, I mean, that is a question that one has to ask, but one never does ask mm-hmm. that question, because we really, I mean, it shows a really nasty side of humanity to question something like that. You don't want to be the person who doubts the victim.
Exactly.
You don't want to be the one who says, hey, maybe this didn't actually happen. I think we are wired to believe, and especially in cases like this when there's a victim involved, you really want to be on the side of the victim.
Precisely. There is another career that we tend, especially here in the Bay Area, tend to admire, and that's fundraiser. We think of the fundraiser who convinces some fat cat to donate millions to some cause aimed at helping the poor, reducing income inequality. Well, fundraisers for nonprofits know that when said fat cat donates that $1 million to some anti-poverty nonprofit, the chances are, in reality, it's going to have little effect. After all, in the last half century, we have spent literally many trillions, with a T, of dollars to close the achievement gap. I just read a U.S. News review of the 50 years of literature that found the achievement gap is nearly as wide as ever. So isn't it a con when a fundraiser builds an emotional connection to the donor and then deceptively implies that donating that million is going to make a real difference in the lives of youth?
Honestly, it depends. It depends on what the intention of the fundraiser is. If the fundraiser is actually genuine and really does think that, you know, yes, in the past we haven't been able to fight this off, but maybe this really will help and really does have good intentions, and honestly, I think that especially in nonprofits, there are a lot of well-intentioned people
mm-hmm,
out there.
Definitely.
Sure, they might not be very effective, but their heart's in the right place.
Yep,
they're going for the right kind of goal. In that case, it's absolutely not a con. It just uses a lot of the same techniques. These people are just effective at fundraising, which in and of itself is a perfectly legitimate thing to be. Now, where it crosses over is where the intention really is nefarious, and I think that that's the dividing line always between is it a con or is it not. Was your intention to deceive, to do something for your own ends, or was your intention benign? We also have, you know, we have borderline cases. So, for instance, I write about Somali Mom, who had an incredibly successful charity for women who were victims of sex trafficking, and it turned out that she was a con artist of sorts, so her own story wasn't true. She wasn't actually a victim of sex trafficking herself. And the stories of the women that she used as spokespeople, she groomed them, she trained them, she told them what to say. Even the ones with horrible stories, she made them even more horrible. She falsified them so that people would give more money. Now, that's a con artist, but she is still... it's an iffy case because her money actually did help a lot of women. So she used deceptive tactics. The end result was good. I would still call her a con artist, but a lot of people still say that, you know what, we still are on her side because she ended up helping a lot of people.
Yeah, it's the end justifies the means kind of argument.
Exactly.
Another kind of maybe gray area, you told an example of religion right here in Oakland, here in the Bay Area. Tell us about that.
That was the Pattons, B.B. Patton and Mr. He joked that his middle name's stood for Cash, C for Cash Patton, C. Thomas Patton. And they were a couple of evangelists. She would preach, and he was amazing at raising money. So he would just harangue his congregation and say, you know, God knows that there is $1,323.12 still out there in the audience today. He'd give these really precise numbers, and they were really, really good. So they ended up being able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we're talking a long time ago. We're talking in the 50s. This is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I can't do the conversion in my head right now, but in today's money, I think we're talking multiple millions of dollars.
Right.
And it turns out that they were con artists because they were using the good faith of their congregation for things like a gambling habit. So he would go to Vegas on the weekends, and the money that he said was going to be spent on missions was really spent for his gambling debts. They both had a shopping problem. He had hundreds of pairs of handmade cowboy boots. She shopped at the dressmaker to the stars, this Hollywood dressmaker who was at that point in time dressing all of the celebrities. So they had multiple cars. Their garage was filled with them. The church that they said they had bought for the congregation, they very nicely put the deeds in their own names because obviously the congregation was never a part of it. And the kicker of this story is that when they were finally caught and they were being tried, a lot of their congregants didn't believe it. Even when confronted with the evidence, one said, hey, look, here's the receipt for a $4,000 gambling debt on the weekend that he said he was going to this mission. People said, no, this is still my religious leader. They refused to believe it. They still stood behind the Pattons, which blows my mind, and yet it's incredibly common.
Yep. Well, what blows my mind is psychics. There's a profession that is rife with it. But let's let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Namco. My guest, who I'm really liking, Maria, you're really able to be concise and fill your stories very, very. You're doing great. Anyway, my guest is Maria Konnikova. She is the author of The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. And I swear, those of you who listen, you know, sometimes I'll say the book is okay, whatever. I am filled with admiration for a person who doesn't pad. I have written 8 books. And I don't like books that have 3 or 4 main points and then they pad with a bunch of crap. It is filled with appropriate anecdote, appropriate research, and she writes very, very well.
Well, so, thank you very much.
Yeah. Anyway, so I certainly commend it to you. So now let's talk about psychics.
Right. Well, I knew you were going to ask that question, Marty.
Very clever, yes. You could see it in your dreams,
well,
right?
I've got my crystal ball right here.
Your premonition, right. Okay, go ahead.
Well, psychics, that's one of the most common scams that we see. I mean, I live in Manhattan, and it's really difficult to walk a block without seeing a psychic parlor. Sometimes there are multiple, 2, 3. Sometimes I've seen as many as 5 parlors on one block.
Wow.
I don't know how San Francisco is, but I'm guessing that it's also pretty bad. And the thing is, their clients, first of all, Manhattan rent's very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. If these places are open, it means a lot of people are giving them money. Secondly, their clients, when you talk to them, not saps, not the types of people you think of as suckers. A lot of people, we've got investment bankers, a lot of Wall Street professionals.
Wow.
Yeah, because basically, what ends up happening is when things go wrong, so this happened especially in 2008, there was a huge spike in Wall Street people who started going to psychics because what happened in 2008? Mm-hmm. Big crash, big meltdown. And everyone wanted answers. Everyone wanted some sort of an edge. And I think their logic was, well, it can't hurt, can it?
Wow.
Of course, the answer is it can hurt.
Right.
Because people, you'd be so surprised at how many people, very intelligent people I've spoken with, who've said, I know that psychics aren't real. I know that this is all a con, that it's a load of crap, that all this stuff is terrible, that, you know, really, I know this. But this one psychic is an exception. This one is the real deal.
Right.
She or he really has something. I don't know what it is, but it's an extra touch. And everyone is convinced that they have found the exception. Of course, if everyone has found the exception, and presumably they're all different exceptions, then all of a sudden you have a totally different profession. It's completely legitimate. And it's not. So these exceptions, we have no proof of them whatsoever. I mean, there are prizes out there for proof of real psychic ability.
Right.
And there have been for over a century. So Harry Houdini one of the first. He gave a huge prize, over $1 million in today's money, for anyone who could prove psychic ability. No one ever claimed it. Today we have the amazing Randy and Penn and Teller. They have a fund that's at right now at way over $1 million. And once again, nobody has claimed it today. So we have no proof that psychics work, and yet people believe it because we want to believe it. And especially when things aren't making sense, when everything's going wrong, be it a financial crash, be it, you know, your love life, it really doesn't matter. People want answers, and they say, it really can't hurt, can it? Let me go to a psychic.
Please, you know, do not even trust my guest or me about this. Please go and simply Google psychics, and no, that won't work. Damn it, there was a book by, Ian. I wrote an article for Psychology Today about psychics in which I reviewed the literature, and certainly look at the Wikipedia profile on psychics, and you'll see how many, just exactly as Maria said, there have been all kinds of, even Harvard professors who claimed, tried to build a career on the paranormal and psi, PSI, the psychic ability, and it's all been debunked. Please, yeah, do that. Look for the Wikipedia profile on psychics. It's garbage. Please, there aren't the exceptions. Tell us the story. You talked about a sophisticated business person. You talked about Lee Chung, who has an MBA from NYU, who ended up giving $128,000 to a psychic, Sylvia Mitchell. Tell the story.
Well, Sylvia Mitchell didn't just bilk Chung out of that money. She had a lot of victims. So when she was finally convicted, so she's actually one of the few who's now serving her prison sentence. Mm. In New York, she had so many high-profile people. By high-profile, I don't mean celebrities. I mean just people who were very successful in their careers, who were their victims. And they all, most of them had love problems, as did Lee Chung. So what was happening was Chung was in love with a coworker, and she really didn't know what to do. This love was seemingly unreciprocated. And she, her mother was sick, so there was a lot going wrong in her life, and she went to see Mitchell. And Mitchell loves to tell people about bad karma from past lives. This is kind of her MO. So, you know, one person was an Egyptian princess who was overly attached to wealth. And she gives you all of these stories, and she said that Chung's family had wronged her lover's family in a past life. So there's just all of this mythical element that you think, oh my God, you know, how does anyone fall for this? But they're very persuasive, and they don't just, you don't walk in and they say, oh, in your past life you were an Egyptian princess. They really build up to this. And so with Chung, they had meditations together. She said, I'm going to do, you know, we're going on spiritual quests together. And this happened over years until she had no money left. She got fired from her job. There was a sexual harassment claim. It was really, really terrible. I feel so awful for this woman. I'm so grateful to her for coming forward because it takes a lot of guts to really admit that you've been conned by a psychic. Because this is not, I mean, unlike, I think we're always really, so we were talking earlier about victims, right, and how nobody wants to question a victim, that we're always on the victim's side, except victims of con artists. We are so quick to blame them. We say, you know, you had it coming. If you were stupid enough to fall for that, well, then you deserve it. And that is just so backwards and so wrong, because we have no sympathy for them, and we should, because this can happen to anyone. Mm-hmm. This can happen to us, and we don't want to believe that. Mm-hmm. So we craft all of these things. Oh, well, you can't fool an honest man. You must be greedy. Something's wrong with you. You're stupid. You're gullible. We dismiss them. We don't listen to them. And so, of course, victims don't come forward because they don't want that reputation. They don't want people to think, how are you so stupid? How are you so gullible? And so most psychics don't go to jail. I mean, they're still operating today. Mitchell was an exception because enough people decided they were going to come forward. So I just want to take a moment to say thank you to everyone who has the guts to admit that they've been conned.
Absolutely love it. Okay. Now, you know, the Bay Area, I'm trying to focus on things that are central to on work. The show's got to focus on work. That's my mandate. And I'm focusing on a Bay Area industry here, the wine industry. It is huge, and yet it's recently come under assault. Indeed, the Huffington Post had top wine experts blind taste three wines, and each reviewer rated one wine much higher and the other one much lower, and then between even the reviewers there was, you know, ones that, oh, this is a great wine, this is a terrible wine, And then it was revealed that all three wines, remember these were blind tasted, were the same wine coming from the same bottle. And so the Huffington Post article was called Wine is BS. So maybe the whole industry is a con, but you tell a great story of an individual wine collector named Rudy Kiriwan. Tell us about his con.
So Rudy Kiriwan was, well, still is, except he's no longer very wealthy, I don't think, because he's now in jail. He was this very wealthy wunderkind who in his 20s kind of exploded onto the wine scene. He started going to auctions, spending lots of money, high-profile purchases. People recognized very quickly that he was a force to be reckoned with because wine collectors do know each other. It's a pretty small community of people willing to spend that amount of cash on wine. But then he really distinguished himself because he had an amazing palate. So he is one of those people who would basically laugh at that Huffington Post article completely accurately because he can taste. He would have absolutely said this is the same bottle of wine. So there are people who are actually have very good palates and do know what they're talking about. He was one of them. So people started respecting him. Then he started throwing parties for not just for wealthy people, but for industry insiders, reviewers, people who really knew about wine. And these became very coveted invitations because he was very generous with the wines he bought. And then he developed a new source. So he found this previously unearthed cellar in France, which does happen occasionally because there's still a lot of old houses. Not everyone has explored all of them. Sometimes there are families that, you know, have been sitting on collections forever and finally decide to do something about it. So he discovered one of these cellars, and there were so many rare bottles of wine that collectors had been trying to find forever and that were incredibly difficult to get your hands on, and Rudy had access to them suddenly. So now he started selling wines, not just buying them at auction, but selling them to individuals and through auction houses, and people just went crazy. They wanted these wines. And he was very selective. He didn't sell to everyone. By the way, much like Bernie Madoff, who wouldn't accept money from everyone, you had to really beg to be invested with Madoff. It was the same thing with Rudy. You had to really beg to be able to get some of his wines. And everyone, you know, this kind of was going along, humming along, and suddenly he was arrested. And as it turns out, he didn't have a magical cellar source. He was creating these wines himself in his basement with a recipe book where he really figured out, you know, how do I make all of these wines? And he mixed really good wines, by the way. It's not like he used bad bottles. They just weren't the exact wines that he said they were. But because his palate was so good, he was able to mix very good forgeries. And so he had duped so many wine collectors into buying Kiriwan fakes. And people had drank these, had said, oh, this is wonderful. He'd served them at dinners, along with real wines, always. He always mixed it with real wines. He was very smart. And this was one of the biggest wine frauds that we've had in recent memory.
And apparently when they discovered him, they found he had a label-making factory in his basement where he was making the phony labels.
Yes, and he used real old labels. He had so many tricks. I mean, he used real old labels, and he just changed them a little bit. He would collect labels off of real bottles of wine and affix them to these fake bottles. I mean, this guy was very, very good. But he was crafting everything, absolutely. He had a whole business in his basement. And you know what? If he didn't have all of that, that's where he went wrong. I think he got a little overconfident. If it hadn't all been in his basement, one can imagine that he wouldn't have been caught nearly as easily. What would have happened if they found nothing on the raid?
You know, there is a principle that was embedded in your story that I've heard again. It's called manufactured scarcity.
Mm.
You know, where businesses try to say, we only have a very small number of wines. We'll give you, we'll release three bottles to you. So the manufactured scarcity, and every schmuck collector wants to get something rare. So even though there's 10,000 cases sitting in a warehouse, they release it as though it was rare. And frankly, I really think that the Harvards and Stanfords of the world do manufactured scarcity as well. And here's why I say so. Because the product, really, when one looks at the value added, of course, Stanford and Harvard and all, they get great students because they've created this air, when in fact, the basis of Stanford and Harvard's reputation is how much research they crank out. The quality of the undergraduate education in many ways is inferior to community college, but they've manufactured scarcity by making it extraordinarily rigorous to get in. Do you think this? I know you're a Harvard graduate. Is there any and Columbia graduate. Is there any legitimacy to my assertion?
Honestly, I don't think so, in the sense that I think that I had an amazing education. And the students I taught at Columbia also were incredible students.
The students are great. It's more the faculty
I'm
talking about.
I think I always, you know, at some of the closest relationships, I'm still friends with all of my undergraduate professors. They have remained mentors throughout my life.
Thank you for disagreeing with me. That's, I appreciate that. I don't expect psychofantasy. Let's talk about I've deliberately tried to give many examples of asked about different examples of different careers and fields in which cons occur. But you say that there is an arc for a typical con game, and it starts with figuring out what the victim wants, then establishing an emotional bond, that's the con in confidence, maybe by telling some story that pulls on the listener's hot button. Then there's something called the logic, the rope, the tail, the breakdown, the send, the blow, blah, blah, blah. Can you pretend you're trying to con me into giving you money and how you would do it step by step?
Sure. Well, first, I would have done a lot of research on you and on your background, and because I am not a con artist, I did not. I read about who you are, but what I would have done is I would have found all of your social media profiles. I would have gone on Facebook, because we have Facebook these days. Mm-hmm. I would have probably friended you on Facebook, especially if we have some friends in common, and I would have you know, started commenting on your posts and liking things for months so that you don't even, you know, we've never even met. I'm not asking you for money. I'm not asking you for anything. But I'm learning about you.
Yeah.
I'm learning about what kind of person you are.
And I'm liking you, because anybody who's liking my stuff and commenting on my stuff intelligently, you are absolutely, I am gaining confidence in you completely.
Exactly, exactly. So you haven't even met me yet, and already you kind of have this familiar ring. You're like, oh, Maria, she's commenting. Again,
right.
She always says great stuff.
Right.
You know, she must be a very perceptive person.
Exactly.
She likes. And by the way, I would be agreeing with you. I wouldn't be disagreeing with you.
Right.
So I would be building this up over a lot of time. You know, if I happen to live in the Bay Area, then I would. If I saw the types of places that you go to, maybe I'd go to one of them so that we can, by mistake, bump into each other.
You'd go to one of my talks.
Exactly. I'd go to your talk and I'd say, oh, my God, hi, it's so nice to finally meet in person, blah, 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 blah. You like me. You trust me.
Right.
We're ready to go.
Right.
We're ready to think.
You bet. You Buddha. I mean, really, that's true. And then what would you do?
So then what I would do is I would start telling you a story. This story would have nothing to do with money.
Right.
Would have nothing to do with what I'm telling you about. But I would say, you know what, you just, let's go out for coffee. You know, we're at this point, you know, we're world buddies.
Right.
We're sitting out down over coffee, and I'd say, you know, the damnedest thing just happened to me. And I would craft some story about how, let's say my best friend was creating this new company, or not my best friend, let's say just someone I used to work with, and they needed some advice and all this stuff, blah, blah, blah. I ended up making so much money. Can you believe that actually happened? Like, I just can't believe that opportunity existed. I would make it so that you would want to know whether there were still some investment opportunities left. I wouldn't actually say, do you want to invest with them? I'd say, yeah, you know, and everyone, they're still looking for investors, and it's so great because so far all of us have really done incredibly well. I'm not a wealthy person, you know, but I was so glad to just have a little extra cash. And all of a sudden you'd be wondering, she doesn't know me very well, but maybe, you know, does she like me enough to put in a good word?
Exactly. You know, it's really the best fundraisers don't do the S. They make the mark eager to make the ad, to make the donation.
Absolutely. Well, that's why con artists are artists. You know, it's all about the soft skills. There's no hard sell here. They're not these, you know, sleazy salesmen who you say, oh, you see them coming, you're trying to sell something to me again. That's not a con artist.
Right.
Con artists, you don't know that, you don't see them coming. You often don't know you've been conned because they are all about the soft touch. It's an art. It's an artistic skill.
It sure
you
is.
You never have to ask for anything. People give it to you. They give you their confidence. They give you their money. They give you their trust, their love, their respect. They give it to you willingly. And that's why a lot of times, you know, it's really actually difficult to prosecute con artists because you can't pinpoint what crime they've committed.
Well, there's one thing for sure, is that Maria Konnikova has not committed a crime in being a guest on this radio show. She's the author of The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time, and I'm fascinated. So would you mind staying on a little longer?
No, not at all.
Awesome. Okay, so as I said, this show is for, I have to enforce them to focus on work. There's many other interests I have, but is there a con or two that is often used by people at work?
Well, I think that people at work often end up conning people without realizing what they're doing, or at least with justifying it initially. So a lot of people will start cutting corners, not just accountants, but anyone who has to deal with money. You know, let's say a trader who had a bad portfolio performance, mm-hmm. or anyone where the numbers are not quite right. You see this, and you don't just see this, by the way, in finance. You see this in academia, a lot of scientists where the data
yep.
hasn't quite come out.
Yep.
And so you change a few numbers, just a little bit. You just fudge it a tiny, tiny bit because you say, it should have come out. The data should have come out,
mm-hmm.
or that trade should have gone my way. You know, you justify it. You say, I just need a little bit of an extra wiggle room
yep.
just for this quarter, and then everything is going to be better. Then it's all going to work out. And what ends up happening is it doesn't work out because there's a reason it didn't work out the first time. And it wasn't that it was meant to work out. It was you really didn't do something wrong. And so usually what ends up happening is you've given yourself license to cheat.
Yep.
So now you start going, I hate the term slippery slope, but it does become
mm-hmm.
something like mm-hmm. that, where then you have to keep doing it because you've already done it. And people will think that something's wrong if you stop doing it. And before you know it, you are just embroiled in an outright con. There's one man that I write about who was a CTO in a company. And I had a chance to speak with his lawyer, who had originally been really sympathetic because it seemed like this guy, you know, exactly this thing had happened. He'd had a bad quarter. He'd fudged a little bit. He'd fixed the books. And then the next quarter didn't get better, so he did it again and again and again. But that it was really, you know, it was for his family. It was for his company. He had a good heart. Good person. You know, this just got out of hand. Well, as it turned out, this guy had been charging hundreds of thousands of dollars on the corporate card for all sorts of things for his family, vacations, private jets, just the whole thing. And, you know, this lawyer's sympathy obviously quickly evaporated. But that's what often happens. You have people who take that moral license are the same people who will then keep going. I write over and over that con artists happen when opportunity meets predisposition.
Right.
In the exact same situation, a lot of scientists wouldn't fudge those numbers. A lot of traders would admit to having had a bad trade. A lot of accountants would admit that, you know, we're sorry, this quarter was
mm-hmm.
just bad. The vast majority would. But there is a small number of people who, if you put them and give them the right opportunity, that's when that side of their character comes out. And once they get away with it,
mm-hmm.
kind of the thrill and the knowledge that they got away with it enables them to do it even more. By the way, my profession is not immune. We have
exactly.
writers and journalists.
All the time.
All the time who start with, you know, who start with one small fact or one small quote, or this person didn't quite say this, but that, let's
mm-hmm.
just make them say that because it looks much better. Or I wasn't quite able to get an interview, but let me pretend that this happened. And all of a sudden, we have people who are creating Pulitzer Prize-winning stories based on a story that doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I believe that it's actually even more subtle. There is an implicitness in that, you know, if you do this stuff, eventually you're going to get caught. If you're subtle enough, most times you don't get caught. The journalist who simply is just very careful to appear being fair and balanced, but very careful to create a straw man on the opposing side, but then somebody who's really strong on their side and selectively reporting what they did say in the interview, rather than taking it a little out of context, using more inflammatory words. You know, if you're against the Republicans, you're going to use fighting words to describe how the Republicans argue with each other. You know, like slammed him and, you know, targeted him and shot at him or whatever. Whereas if you're a pro-Democrat, you might say they express their disagreement in this way. There's a million subtle cons, and they know that if you're subtle enough, you're going to get caught. And I know academia really well. And I know that academics, especially in the social sciences, where you say there's opportunity. See, in the hard science, it's hard in physics to manipulate electrons illegally. But when you're dealing with human beings and samples, sample sizes and how you're really selecting your sample and what statistical method you use, and do you adjust your statistical method afterwards to conform to your a priori hypotheses. There's all these subtle cons, and the chances are you ain't gonna get caught. What's your reaction?
Well, I think that you shouldn't let physicists off too soon. Honestly, no, I think you can do this everywhere.
Reasons.
I think the social scientists get an unfair reputation just because people have happened to focus on that in the last few years. But so I would once again, though, draw the line between, I don't think that what you're talking about with journalists, with language choices, that's spin. I mean, that's not a con. Once we start calling something like that a con, the word stops meaning anything because we can put so many things into that category. Then all advertising, all marketing, all politicians, all lawyers, everyone becomes a con artist, and then it stops meaning anything. So I think, once again, we have to be very careful. Are you knowingly deceiving, or are you just making a stronger case? You know, entire publications aren't cons, they just give a political spin. Once you start playing with numbers, fudging data, fudging quotes, then it's in con territory. And I think that a lot of academia does have opportunity for that. There's huge pressure, and we do see fraud happening in all matters of places. Now, let's get out of the social sciences. There was recently a case in Michigan, I want to say, with AIDS, where it ended up that a lot of the AIDS data had been falsified. There's been falsification of cloning data. You say we can't manipulate electrons, sure, but we can manipulate the data and say that you saw something that you didn't see. And sometimes it's not even the PI. Sometimes it happens at lower levels. You have postdocs, you have grad students who want results. And so they will fudge the data. The advisor will believe them. The advisor is the one who ends up suffering.
I know you're liking to maintain the purity of the term con, but truly, isn't it a continuum on the degree of deception?
Well, you know, it is a continuum. It's a fuzzy line, but I honestly don't think that people who are, you know, I think that we do have to be careful with our terms here, because if you say that it's all people who use spin are con artists, then absolutely everyone is a con artist, honestly. There's not a single person who doesn't exaggerate, and you just notice it when you disagree with it. You don't notice it when you agree with it. And this happens in every single profession. It happens in most social interactions. And so I do think that it is, yes, sure, it's a continuum, absolutely, but we also have to be very clear and careful with our terms.
Well, let me see where this would fall. The salesperson. You know, we all know the salesperson. Every sales training program in history talks about the importance of developing a rapport with the person. That's what you were talking about with doing with me. Then they overhype the product, which is, conscious. It's not inadvertent. They consciously overhype the product. They consciously hide their weaknesses. That's standard. And or in a job interview, again, I'm staying on the work front. The employer is saying it's a great place to work when it's not, while at the same time the job seeker is exaggerating his or her capabilities. It's been said that a job interview are two people lying to each other. Are these not cons?
No, they're not. It's social lying, which happens all the time. When you ask me how I'm doing, you don't really care how I'm doing. When I tell you I'm doing great, I'm not really doing great. Those types of things smooth social interaction all the time, and we know about it. And yes, we know that people oversell products. But if you actually believe in your product, and if you're actually just doing your job, and you have no nefarious motive there, then you're not a con artist. Now, if you're Volkswagen and you're actually employing a huge deception to say, you know, our cars are better than they actually are, or, you know, I'm picking on one company, let's just say, you know, if you're any company, and you actually deceive and you hide safety data and people are instructed to lie about certain things, then it becomes a con.
You know, we really do need to kind of bring this to a conclusion, but I have two more questions I want to ask you. One is, you cite research in your book, and the book, by the way, is The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time, and I swear I really do commend it to you. It's very well written and filled with interesting anecdote and research behind it. You'll enjoy it, I promise. Anyway, the book cites research that organizations that, quote, have greater structure and less flexibility for making decisions according to one's own whims, were significantly less likely to act in con-like ways, end quote. We'd like to believe that most people act honestly because they believe it's the right thing to do, but that research suggests that many employees only behave well when they're forced to and they're given little freedom. What's your thoughts?
Absolutely. So I do think, once again, we've got predisposition and we've got opportunity.
Mm-hmm, right.
And there are people who are predisposed who, if you put them in one type of environment, they're going to be just fine. They're going to be good citizens. If the tone at the top is the right tone, it says there are consequences here. We're an ethical organization, and they actually act on that. So you see that there are really no bad actors, and bad actors aren't tolerated, that there are very harsh repercussions. Then you have companies where it's a kind of don't ask, don't tell type of policy where, you know, we don't really care where you're getting your information as long as your returns are good. So here we're talking about, a financial company. Or we'll look the other way. The tone at the top is incredibly different. Well, in those situations, that there's the opportunity. And so that exact same person is going to become a con artist. And so I think that institutions are incredibly important to keep people in check, because there are bad apples out there, and the organization really does matter. Bad apples flourish when the organization itself is a rotten tree.
I normally go and take a number of calls when I have a guest, but you've been so good, I really wanted to maximize my questions and give you a chance to answer these. But somebody has called in without even my giving out the phone number, so we've got to be at least half decent to him or her. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. What is your question for Maria Konnikova, the author of The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time?
Hi, thank you for taking my call during this fascinating discussion.
Good.
I am a little bit puzzled as to the distinction between deception and con. And I'm wondering if, because deceiving one another and ourselves is such a pervasive part of our economy, never mind society. Do we do our children a disservice by requiring or demanding that they be scrupulously honest? And are people who are scrupulously honest in life at a distinct disadvantage?
Maria, good question, Colin.
Yeah. It's a very good question. No, I don't think we're doing them a disservice. I think people should value honesty. And when we're talking about deception in society, we're not talking about real deception in the sense of things that really hurt people. We're talking about white lies, things that just facilitate social interaction. But you don't always want to be honest, and I think kids will realize this very quickly. If someone looks terrible today, you don't want to say, "Oh, you look terrible today." That will hurt their feelings, and that's the honest thing to say, but you're not going to say that. You're going to say, "Oh, no, you look wonderful. I couldn't tell. I definitely couldn't tell." And everyone is going to emerge from that interaction much happier. So I think there's a difference in quality, a difference in type of lies, and it's good to have a good moral compass, because then when we're talking about predisposition and opportunity, then when the opportunity arises, your kid is going to be the kid who is going to be honest, and who then, yeah, sure, he might have worse performance in that particular quarter, but then he's not going to go to jail. And I think that that's a worthy trade-off.
I'm going to kind of disagree with Maria here. I think the more you can have an honest, nuanced conversation, of course, it's going to vary with the age, but about, what are the risks and rewards, psychic, not just pragmatic risks and rewards, but the benefits to all stakeholders, to the recipient, to society, of being honest and not, and thinking in that complex way before you decide whether you're going to be honest or not.
Absolutely.
In weighing that would seem to be the kind of, rather than the George Washington, let's be honest all the time, but presenting that continuum, that multi-stakeholder approach, would be the way I'd want to treat my daughter. Maria, you sound like you want to jump on that.
No, I totally agree with that, but I think that you still teach people to be honest, and then you teach them to be complex, because George Washington, by the way, was not an honest person. That is completely just a misremembrance of history. I mean, he was a politician. He deceived a lot of people to get to where he was, and on a personal level and on a professional level. So I think that you still teach people the right values. You don't teach people sometimes you got to cut corners, kid. You teach them the right values, but one of those values is knowing to balance different sorts of morals. There's not just one virtue, honesty above all else. There are multiple virtues.
Caller,
you have to balance them.
Caller, what's your reaction to all this?
Well, I'm not about
wildlife
killing someone.
You're cutting out. Are you moving around or something?
I'm not talking about white lies, like telling somebody they look like they lost 10 pounds. I'm talking about the lies that were told, like in fine print, after, you know, being given a fabulous deal by the phone company.
Mm-hmm.
Or when we go to buy a car. These are economically based lies in which the buyer is usually at a disadvantage of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of machinations that we have to engage in order to get some sort of quote-unquote deal.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I fall on the side of trying to empower the consumer, so it be a kid or whatever. You know, there's an old Muslim saying that says, trust in Allah, but tie your camel tight. And so I think that's the message that I'd want to give, is that
exactly.
You start a priori with a moderate measure of trust, but you need to, you know, or trust but verify is the other.
Absolutely.
I think Reagan said that, trust but verify. So it's that, again, it's that nuance. But I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much for calling in. Okay, well, I guess she's gone. Anyway, Maria, we are out of time, but you don't listen to the show, so you don't know whether I'm conning you or not, or being dishonest. But I really see that your book has a degree of thoroughness that really is unusually impressive and good. From a characterological perspective, now, you know, the show's on work, so as a writer, as a thinker, as a human being, what is the factor or factors that drove you to be so thorough, really?
Well, I think it's very important to understand how con artists operate, and I'm trying to empower people to both recognize some of the signs of con so that they feel better about their ability to counteract them, but also to give people permission to come forward, to give victims permission to speak, and to really change the dialogue so that we really start blaming the con artists and not the victims. Because in our society, we glamorize the con artists and we blame the victim, and I think that's completely backwards.
Well, I agree with you, obviously, and I really do. You should, you know, I've been doing the show in almost 26 and a half years now. You are one of the best guests, and I've had luminaries, true luminaries from all over the world. There's very few people that have the intelligence, the concision, the facts, and the light tone. You have an easy-to-listen-to tone. You should be spending a lot of time in the media. I hope you keep writing books, but also you are the perfect person for a media tour and any kind of public work. You did great.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Good, Maria. You take care and be well.
Bye-bye.
Okay. All right. Now, dear listeners, we have about 10 minutes. Now I'm turning to you. I don't want to hear anything about cons. All I want to hear about is you or the problem that you or someone you care about is facing at work. And I will try to help with what I call a workover. Whether you're 16 or 76, you're unemployed or well-employed, but still unhappy, you've got a work problem. This is what I'm here to do, and I want to try to help you. Of course, the price is right. Zero, zippo, nada. The phone number here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I wrote an article a few months ago called Unvarnished, straight talk about what works in the real world. And the older I get, the more I believe that brevity is very valuable. There have been millions of tomes that have been written that sit in dusty bookshelves or on Google Docs or whatever that nobody ever reads. And in the end, at the risk of sounding simplistic, I like to think that the short tips of advice end up net-net making a bigger difference in the world. So I want to share some of these unvarnished straight talk points. And of course, those of you who have been regular listeners to the show, some of the stuff has been said here before, but these are things I profoundly believe in. Status is the enemy of success. Status often forces you into a career you don't like or you have trouble competing in. And then you end up buying expensive things that force you to stay in that career. A Tony address, a fancy car, designer label clothes, expensive vacations. And all of those end up bringing less pleasure than the displeasures required to afford that stuff. So we all find it's cool to work in biotech or entertainment or the environment. But because so many of us are attracted in that direction, the competition is bizarre. So it is really very wise to realize that your sense of value at work is not contingent on the status of the work. I know somebody, for example, who ran a scrap metal business, used scrap metal. Nothing is lower status. But he felt great about his life, and he made a big contribution in the world because he was an expert at sourcing various kinds of scrap metal from Russia, the Belarus, all kinds of places that I would never have known, and he was able to be a brilliant broker of those scrap metals. And as long as he wasn't pulling a con, he was a reasonably honest person. He realized that status is the enemy of contentment and of success, and went under the radar. So, yes, if you can't see yourself living without competing in acting or in the environment or biotech or whatever, then you may have to do it. But we don't get unconsciously sucked in to that meme that status is the way to contentment and success. All right, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, am I in the air?
You are.
My goodness. Okay, my name is Earl. And I called because you asked about problems that I viewers or listeners are facing,
right?
In terms of the job. So I'm over 65, and I had a long career in the sciences with a PhD and a postdoc and all that kind of stuff.
A PhD
and,
in what?
In biochemistry. It's
okay,
out.
Great.
Pharmaceutical research.
Uh-huh.
And during all that time, actually in graduate school, I bought a house. So I've been working on my house,
yeah,
if you will. And through circumstances, I ended up pursuing working on other people's houses, kind of a project manager, handyman,
right?
More managing and less handy. And the question is, which do I pursue? I'm in a position where I need to do one or the other. Those are the two things I like doing and have experience in.
Right.
How do you decide?
Well, first of all, how current, you know, normally a guy who's 65 plus, you know, the field,
yeah,
is rapidly changing, the instrumentation is changing, a lot is changing. It sounds like you've been out of the game a while. Wouldn't it take you go ahead. What were you going to do?
No. Of course, that's the first thing. And the answer is I have enough background that in certain areas, I can pick it up pretty fast, and I do follow it, but not the same as a younger person, that's for sure. However, what I do have and what I find that it's more a matter of managing people, and whether it's in the construction side or in the laboratory side, research side of things, or research or development a little bit, early development, I know enough about it to look at things and ask questions. And
you know what?
And,
here's my gut. My gut's taking,
yeah,
there's going to be a certain amount of time that it's going to take you to get up to speed. And while you're doing, you know, management in the end is going to, a fair amount of the time, it's not just managing budgets or whatever. It's understanding the hard problems so that when your worker bees are stuck, they can come to you. As a guy,
yeah,
who's 65 plus, who is needs some time to get back up to speed, and because there's going to be an understandable reluctance to hire somebody who's in his late 60s, it's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like the risk-reward ratio, given you were very clear and said you like both of those things, managing these kind of handyman plus projects,
yep,
it seems to me much smarter to make your pharma thing as a hobby. Do take on some little cute little project that you're curious about, play with some molecules on some modeling software or whatever and do what you want, you know, design some interesting molecule for treating whatever, if you just for the fun of it. But it seems to me, especially if you're 65, we don't want you to be, you know, having your body craned under a building where you're going to hurt your back because you're not going to heal as fast as when you're 45. I like the idea of a guy who's very smart, like a guy who's got it smart enough to get a PhD, managing projects, you know, that are, you know, maybe a little like remodels or whatever, because most people,
exactly,
don't have half your IQ. And so you would compete very successfully in that space of managing those fairly small commercial or residential renovation projects. Do you buy my analysis?
Yeah, okay. I do. In fact, I've been thinking about that and trying, and those are the concerns. The projects I've actually been able to run into are, you know, this is in the mid-peninsula, so, you know, multi-hundred thousand or million dollar, you know, residential things. And it's not necessarily that I'm smarter, but I can apply myself to it. Somebody's busy doing something else.
Okay.
They've got a career.
The question I always ask is, if money is a factor, are you going to be the guy who's going to be able to go to the general contractors and try to get their overage, their small jobs that are too small for them to deal with? Is it going to be going back to your existing customers and asking for referrals? Is it doing workshops? What's the Earl way?
I think it's probably by working through... where do I get customers? Is through reference, whether it's with contractors. I do know a lot of contractors and current, because I've been working, you know, doing that in the last couple of years. And clients, both, I think.
Okay. So that's, you know, I think that's where that feels pretty clear to me. You know, I'm not asking you to abandon your interest in molecular biology. It's kind of fun, and biochemistry. But take it on as find a little hobby project that you could tackle. It could be anything from deciding you're going to, you know, create a better surfactant for adhering fungicides or whatever. But take some little cool project where you could commandeer it, but it's small enough that you could do it, you know, with either actual empirical wet experiments or dry experiments with computer simulations. So you've got that still in the game, but you're kind of your living is becoming like the under the radar subgeneral contractor for small projects. How's that sound?
Sounds great, and I think you read my mind and kind of confirmed some of the things I was thinking about, so I really appreciate it. And I have to say that the woman I heard just the end of it, Tom Kahn, I agree with everything you said about her at the end. I mean, she was great.
She was great. It was a real privilege. You know, I love that. When you never know. You pre-interview your guests, and you never know how good they're going to be, but I was confident she was going to be, pardon the pun, confidence game. I was confident she was going to be awesome, and she was. Anyway, thank you very much for calling.
Well, thank you for your answer, and I appreciate it. You are an undiscovered, or let's say underappreciated gem.
After 27 years, I'm still underdiscovered. God knows how long it's going to take. Anyway, all right. You take care. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, who I really, really appreciate. She's so careful. I really like it. And, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And what sort of careers are available for gadget freaks? I will talk with the president of the Consumer Electronics Association. I have pre-interviewed him. The guy is great. So anyway, you'll enjoy that. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.